Good afternoon. This is Susan McGinnis for KUAC-FM, and this is Sunday at Noon. You know, in this country, we love the works of Herman Melville, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Henry David Thoreau. We may quote Ralph Waldo Emerson, and we honor Alexander Hamilton. We have great respect for Margaret Fuller and for Willa Cather. Looking around the world and over time, there was Socrates, Alexander the Great, Michelangelo, and Tchaikovsky, Walt Whitman, Bessie Smith, and Tennessee Williams. And yet there is no denying our culture is hostile to homosexuality. By and large, homosexuals make Americans nervous, uncomfortable, and for some, even revulsed. We can't know what life was like for the young Walt Whitman or for Willa Cather when she was a girl, but we can guess, if we think about it, that no matter what the era, growing up gay is much harder than growing up straight. And the achievements of those I've just mentioned were ever so much more astounding, considering their sexual orientation. Today on Sunday at Noon, Growing Up Gay in America. My guests today are Dr. Robert Deischer, Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics at the University of Washington, and Dr. Gary Remifedi, Medical Coordinator of the Adolescent Health Program in Pediatrics at University of Minnesota Hospital. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today. This question is probably terribly general, but I do want to ask it to lay a foundation of what we might be talking about today. And that is, where does homosexuality come from as differentiated from heterosexuality? Does anyone know?
I don't think that we know. It's something that people have debated about for years, and there are periods when one theory is in vogue. For instance, perhaps 20 years ago, it was felt that this was brought about by parents. I think everybody knows of the overly possessive mother and the distant, removed father. I think these theories have been totally discredited. Now, there are others which some people feel it's more genetic. Others think that it's something that happens at the child in utero and may be somewhat dependent on level of the mother's circulating hormones at that time. Perhaps you've got some other theories, Gary.
Well, I think you're very correct in reflecting the confusion about the subject. There is a constant debate that's gone on through the decades about the biological versus the environmental influences on sexual orientation. Personally, I'm inclined to take a more biological perspective based on the fact that children seem to establish their sexual orientation very early on in life, probably before the time they enter school. And some of the most compelling arguments on behalf of a biological component are studies of twins, identical twins who are either reared in the same household or, interestingly enough, reared in different environments. And whether or not they grew up together, there seems to be a strong connection between the sexual orientation of the twins. This is not to say that there can't also be environmental influences, and I think that a culture's attitude towards homosexuality affects the apparent visibility of homosexual behavior in homosexual cultures. In any case, the debate goes on, and we still don't have a good answer to that question, I think because we haven't quite studied the question appropriately and devoted the attention to it that some of us think is important. The last thing I would mention on the subject of why people are gay or straight is it's a rather moot question. We usually don't ask the question of why is something the way it is unless we think it's peculiar in the first place. And so I think we need to understand that some of those attitudinal issues are at the bottom of the question. And I think in recent years, more attention has been focusing in on the process by which children develop a sexual orientation over time and how that affects their subsequent life rather than why are they the way they are.
I think you might add that we don't know why kids grow up to be heterosexual either. Mm-hmm. This hasn't been any better understood. I think the important thing is, though, that we do know this is not a choice, and that the child or the adult should not be blamed. Many people say, well, you could be different. I think this is where I thoroughly disagree. It is not a matter of choice.
Although it's interesting, in the last few years, it seems that the phrase lifestyle choice has become very common in American discussions of gayness, as opposed to pathology, which had been an earlier discussion. It was an illness for a great many years, or perceived as an illness.
Well, I'm afraid my opinion of people who think that this is a choice is that they just are uninformed, because I think there is no question. Small children, you can often tell they're going to be gay. They don't know what being gay is all about, yet there are certain characteristics that are exhibited in quite young children, 4 and 5 years old, where we know that this is a pattern that is consistent with later development of gay behavior. And these children do not choose this. And I think this is one of the most harmful things that society does, is say, oh, you could be different if you wanted to. It's a choice. Mm-hmm. This is not true.
We're talking today about growing up gay in America on Sunday at Noon. My guests are Dr. Robert Deischer, who you just heard, and Dr. Gary Remifedi. Gentlemen, the next foundation-laying question I have is the source of homophobia, because it seems to be widespread in our culture and in a great many others, but it does pertain very much to our discussion about growing up gay. Your thoughts on homophobia and where it arises in the human spirit? Do we have a propensity for prejudice in general?
That's another excellent question, and homophobia is very deeply rooted in our culture, in the history of Western civilization, in the beginning with the era of Christianity. We understand that in previous cultures of the West, such as in Greek and earlier Roman cultures, that was not the case. We know also in our own country, in the United States, among Native American populations, that homophobia was not in existence to the extent that it was in Western cultures. And in fact, many of the Indian cultures integrated homosexual people and valued homosexual people in their civilizations and found important roles for them, including spiritual roles.
Mm-hmm. The role of the shaman.
That's right.
Yeah.
So how homophobia evolved in Western culture is a very interesting history. Scholars such as Boswell from Yale have written about it in a really good book called Christianity, Homosexuality, and Social Intolerance. And Boswell's contention was not that religion was the root of homophobia, but that the advent of Christianity was coincident with the advent of homophobia, and that it reflected changes in social structures and new civilizations, new thoughts reacting against ancient worlds in which homosexuality was valued and integrated into the culture. So basically it was a new civilization reacting against an old civilization. And that reaction became very integrated within the thinking of the new culture that was emerging and perpetuated from one generation to another.
Mm-hmm. Homophobia in our time and place? A look at it from you, gentlemen? Bob Deischer, your thoughts?
Well, I agree with Gary. I think that it was a little later in the Christian era that homophobia really developed, because in the early church this was quite well tolerated. And in fact, in the Middle Ages, particularly in the early Middle Ages, it was a very institutionalized thing. There were many higher church officials that were quite openly homosexual. I think it ties in a lot with economics, politics. I think that around the 13th, 14th century, it really began to be most noticed. And at that time, it was very definitely tied in with a lot of politics. And in France, it had to do with some of the persecutions of some of the religious orders, which was done largely to take their money. And the French kings at that time wanted the wealth of these organizations, and one of the things that was very convenient was to accuse them of something, and since there was very little they could come up with, this became popular, and many people at that time were burned at the stake and all other atrocities were committed. But I think the background was really political power, greed, economics, and then it sort of became institutionalized in a way.
Mm-hmm. Can we come from the 13th, 14th century to the present? And because what I want to do is to gain an understanding of what it's like to grow up gay in America in this time and this place, I want to take a look at homophobia now. We can go back 40 years and look at Hitler's treatment, the Nazis' treatment of homosexuals, along with Jews and other unpopular Europeans, so to speak. But in 1989, in 1950, 1960, what kind of a response might society have to gay people in this country?
Well, there's a terrible problem with homophobia throughout this century. Earlier in the century, it was not as vivid as it currently is and has been in other decades as well. In the United States, earlier on in the century, homosexual behavior was fairly conventional, perhaps unspoken, but certainly not the object of as much attention as it is today. What was going on in Europe during the 1940s is that when the fascists decided to select a target to victimize the homosexual people, and the most obvious homosexual people were the easiest targets. Mm-hmm. And they were people who did not have spokespersons to defend them. And they were rounded up and slaughtered in the Holocaust. And there was very little objection to their persecution. Interestingly enough, that was the time of the first sexology research that was being done on gay people, and the lists that sexual researchers collected became the lists that were used to round up gay people for the prison camps. In the United States, at the time, the World Wars brought together men and women from across the country for the first time, and gay men and lesbian women for the first time realized that they were not alone. And they met each other in the military, or they met each other back home in the workplace, and suddenly there was a new consciousness about the existence of other homosexual people. After the war, the United States returned to very traditional values. Men came back to resume their roles in the workplace, and women were relegated back to their homes, and yet they carried with them the memories that there were other people who shared similar feelings to themselves. With time, they gravitated to urban centers, the Village in New York or the Castro in San Francisco, and they went to those places looking for a refuge and a place to find economic, political, religious, and other forms of security, and became isolated from mainstream culture, which fueled homophobia even more. In the present day, homophobia persists at perhaps unprecedented levels and is expressed in discrimination against gay people, which is sanctioned throughout the country, the basic deprivation of human rights for lesbian and gay persons, the persecution of people who are ill, the blaming of people who are ill, the lack of education of professionals about these issues, the lack of public assistance to populations of people who require assistance to overcome the social barriers that have created their problems in the first place. So homophobia is alive and well, and also internalized within lesbian and gay people themselves. This brings us to the situation for gay teenagers. You know, all kids grow up with the same messages in our society, and we all know that being homosexual isn't okay. And for a young person who is growing up to identify himself or herself as being lesbian or gay, they too internalize those messages and lose their self-esteem and engage in self-defeating behaviors and self-compromising behaviors as a consequence.
Let's look then at adolescence. Bob Dasher, why is adolescence such a pivotal time for a youngster who might be gay? Well, for any youngster.
Well, I think that's it for any youngster, because we all know that adolescence is a very stressful time, and even the best adjusted adolescent has to go through a lot of turmoil and face a lot of problems in determining who they are, what they're going to do, and deal with a lot of very confusing and conflicting feelings. And when this person has feelings that are not the same as the peer group, and knowing that these feelings are things that are frowned on, and knows that if he or she were to express them, that they would be ostracized, that they would probably lose their friends. Anyone who works with adolescent has just innumerable stories that teenagers can tell you about what has happened to them when they have been open enough to talk about these feelings. I think most of the teenagers, particularly the younger ones, you shouldn't really call them gay. They're dealing with a lot of sexual issues, and many of them don't know just what they mean, what they are. But if they talk about these things, they know that their family is going to reject them. They're going to be considered sinners by the church. Their friends are going to pick on them mercifully, and it's just very hard to have to face this at a time when you're unsure of yourself, and gay adolescents are going through the same other things that any other teenagers are. But they have this additional conflict, which is a very serious one and causes a great deal of sometimes depression and even suicide among them.
We're talking again with Dr. Gary Remifetti, who is medical coordinator of the Adolescent Health Program at University of Minnesota Hospital, and Robert W. Deischer, professor emeritus of pediatrics at the University of Washington. Dr. Deischer also conducts research on adolescent homosexuality, substance abuse, and sexual offenders, and as well as other areas related to young people. He is a principal investigator for the Juvenile Sexual Offenders Program. Is that in Seattle?
Yes.
Sir? Yeah. And a consultant for the Mission Creek Youth Camp, a camp for juvenile delinquents also in the Washington area. Dr. Gary Remifetti is medical coordinator, as I've said, for the Adolescent Health Program of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota Hospital. He is director of the University of Minnesota's Youth and AIDS Project and a leading researcher and lecturer on the subjects of gay and lesbian youth, gay adolescents in the AIDS era, and adolescent homosexuality. Adolescence is a time when young people are searching for some sort of a stable identity for themselves, as well as you said, Bob, looking for their goals in life, looking for some sort of emancipation for the family. Role models and guides, I suppose, are very important, and feeling a part of a group, I suppose, are very important for adolescents. At this far distance from my adolescence, it's sometimes hard to remember. How is this for gay children who may not have a role model, or who may not have guides who can talk to them about who they are and how they are?
It's very difficult for gay and lesbian adolescents. As you mentioned, one of the most important tasks of adolescence is to develop one's own individuality separate from the family, and we do this by identifying with a peer group. For gay kids, there is no peer group to identify with, and they often suffer terrible isolation. Another one of the important developmental tasks of adolescence is to learn intimacy with another individual. Without that intimacy, we live very isolated in our adult lives. And for young gay people who don't have partners of the same gender to explore intimacy on an emotional and a physical level, that's a significant impairment for their adult life.
One of the criticisms of gay males, adults, is that they are promiscuous. Is that related to not being able to find a way to be intimate as youngsters? Or not? Is that a different phenomenon?
It may perhaps be related. I tend to think of that as something of the past, a part of the history of gay culture, in which gay people in defending themselves against a heterosexual world rejected the values of the conventional values of marriage and monogamy and tried to explore new routes of intimacy with other people.
But I wonder if those routes were even open to them. There isn't a place in the United States where you can get married if you're a gay person, is there?
Well, those possibilities were not open, and also those possibilities were, in a sense, rejected as not possible. Mm. And I think the values of the 70s were to be proud of one's body, to be proud of one's sexuality, and to explore sexual intimacy with freedom. And that was true of both heterosexual as well as homosexual populations. With the advent of AIDS, certainly the situation has changed and the sensibilities of the time have changed, and gay people have made a remarkable response in changing their behaviors and changing the norms of their culture.
And what about gay teens in your work with AIDS? Are they being able to change, are they able to know enough to change their behavior? It seems that there's great difficulty in local school systems in helping kids understand the dangers of other STDs as well as
yes.
AIDS.
And gay teens really are not gay adults in their approach to AIDS. They don't have access to the same good information that gay adults have. They're out exploring their sexualities, and that's a necessary process for them, and they receive very little direction into how to do that safely. Many of them face serious social problems, such as rejection by families and living on the streets and not having an education and a vocation, a visible means of support, and as a consequence have to resort to prostitution for survival. So because their educational situation's different and their social situation's different, the process of exploring their sexuality puts them at very high risk for acquiring HIV.
When you're talking about kids who are resorting, for example, to prostitution, are you talking about runaways? Are you talking about kids who are still living at home? Where is this coming from?
Well, the boys in prostitution are a diverse group. Some of them depend on prostitution for their survival, and others merely engage in prostitution on a more episodic basis as they're exploring their sexual identities. There are many different entrees into prostitution.
I think it's important that we don't get the idea that most gay teenagers are into prostitution, because it's really a small number. I work with runaways, street kids, and the number of gay kids among this group is proportionately high. The majority, of course, are heterosexual, but there is a higher number of gay kids in this group. And I find one of the big reasons is because they've been rejected by their families. I find many kids, as soon as their parents find out they're gay, and this can happen in a kid being open and perhaps telling the parents or them hearing something, there are many ways it can happen, and they will literally throw the kid out. And I've seen some very pathetic situations where kid wanted to go home and would call home every week and ask if he could come home, and his sister would tell him, don't come home, your mother won't let you in the house. This particular kid was one who was rather immature and really needed to be home. He shouldn't be on the street and wouldn't have been there. I've had situations, I remember one boy told me that he left home because his father found out, I don't remember how, that he was gay, put the shotgun on the table and said, I'll give you 30 minutes to get everything you own out of this house, and if I ever see you again, I'll shoot you. And that's just one of many stories of this kind. But I think that these kids need a home. They need parents. They need understanding. They're not going to be particularly promiscuous or running away unless they're forced into it. And the majority of kids we find that are gay, that are on the streets, are really forced into it. Sometimes it's psychological abuse, a kid being ridiculed by family, by peers, until he just can't take it anymore and runs away. The unfortunate thing is when a teenager reaches the street, it's a very dangerous and destructive place, and they get caught up into this, just like the heterosexuals do. And what happens is just, I think, very unfortunate. And many times we, as parents and as a society, have forced these kids into this.
Dr. Bob Dyscher from the University of Washington. Is the reaction of parents, it can't be, always that extreme, the shotgun on the table, I'll give you 30 minutes to get out of the house?
I mean, no, it's not always that extreme. I've had parents bring kids in and just say that, you know, they wanted to talk about this and they wanted to talk with a third party because they didn't know much about it. They didn't understand it. And usually they've had pretty good relations with their parents and have told the parent that they have these feelings, and the parent was confused and wanted to talk to someone. And many of these parents have been supportive and understanding. Mm-hmm. I mean, and these are not kids that are promiscuous or run away. These are kids who stay in school, complete school, often go on to higher education. We referred a little while ago to models, and I wanted to just come back to that a little mm-hmm. bit, because I think any teenager needs a role model. They need to see other people whom they can emulate, bounce ideas off, relate to. And the gay world has almost nothing in the way of models. You mentioned earlier people like Walt Whitman and people who were famous. Well, they were visible not as teenagers, but after they became famous. And kids can't identify with that sort of person. Most adults in their lives are totally unwilling to disclose in any way that they might be homosexual. They don't want to be seen in this way. They don't want anybody to know it, because often it may mean their job or end of relations with someone. It's dangerous. I think we all know of numerous interests where people have lost jobs and even had to move away from communities when someone discovered that they were gay. Well, they're not going to be visible to young people, so the young person often thinks he's the only one in the world, mm-hmm. because each adolescent keeps this as a very closely guarded secret, and they don't talk about it with each other. And if there's no adult whom they can identify with, they just have to hold this in. And I think this is one of the big reasons that we do have as much depression and suicide among this group.
There's another quality to our society that may well inhibit the comfortable growing up of gay kids, and that's that we seem to be sexually obsessed in many ways as a society, but at the same time, we don't talk about sexuality, period, in our homes or schools or other places. If people want to bring in a sex education program into the schools, the community begins to twitch about it. I would expect this is an inhibitor, too, as well, for both the parents who are discovering a gay child, which must be a shock, and for the child discovering that he or she is gay, which is a huge shock.
Well, this has many other ramifications, too. I think that we are a very sex-negative culture. We don't want to deal with sexuality. We don't talk about it with our young people. This spring, I had the opportunity to visit several countries in Europe, and I was particularly looking at teenage pregnancy, trying to see why some of those countries, such as the Netherlands, has one of the lowest teenage pregnancy incidence of teenage pregnancy in the world. Well, they are very open about sex education. It begins at a very early age. It's nothing like in this country. It's interesting, too, that they have less street kids, less adolescents with the sort of problems that we have, because I think that the whole culture is much more supportive, as well as, of course, the parents.
Mm-hmm. Can we get there from here with our culture?
Well, I think we certainly can, but whether we will or not, I think that one thing that's needed is a lot more understanding and education on the part of the general public. Our society is not one that I think has a serious interest in its young people. I work a lot with street kids, with prostitutes, with their babies, and how we as a country can so totally disregard this group and provide them almost no services. It's just amazing to me. I think that if you look at countries in Western Europe, I mean, we have a great deal to be very ashamed of in this country.
It's a very interesting statement that we don't take a serious interest in our children.
No, we don't.
Amplify. I think people would like to listen to that.
We think we do, but if you look at the support we give to services for street kids, the number of teenage pregnancies, everybody knows this is a national problem. What have we done? In the last 10 years, we've closed practically every home for unmarried mothers. The services that are available for girls when they become pregnant, unless, of course, that they're from a family who is fairly well-to-do and supportive. And I don't say that there aren't families who do support them, but there's a tremendous amount of number of kids who get no support from the family. And certainly when you turn to the community, resources for pregnant girls, for girls that have had babies, there's no place for them to live. There are no services for them. Many of them are very involved in drug use. We have in Seattle we work with about 100 young women a year who are prostitutes, pregnant, have cocaine-addicted babies, and the services that are available are almost nil. Yet these children are going to grow up. They're not going to be very functional. They're going to be handicapped. They're probably going to have to be in special education. Heaven knows what they'll turn out to be as adults. And yet we blithely go along spending our money on totally other things. I mean, you can't get funding at any level, federal, state, community level, for the needs of these kids. I think it's just a national disgrace.
Gary Rimafetti, would you agree? Have we
Absolutely.
Forgotten our kids?
I would even go a step further and say not only do we not provide services for them, but we actually blame teenagers for all the problems, particularly in the sexual arena. In our society, we use young people for their physical beauty. We put them in the media, we put them in the movies, we put them in the beauty pageants, we glamorize sexuality, we tantalize them with it, and yet we provide them no direction as to how to use their sexuality appropriately. As a consequence, they run into all sorts of problems, be it pregnancy for the heterosexual teenager or sexually transmitted diseases, or for the gay teenager, HIV infections or other problems that they might have.
Right,
absolutely. And we will blame them for those problems ultimately and hold them responsible. We look at our teenagers as being irresponsible in their sexual expression and selfish and having lack of concern for morality and having lack of direction in their lives and blame them for the sins of their elders.
Gentlemen, if we have done this, I should say to the audience again, for people who are turning in late, we're talking to two pediatricians, and we've begun this conversation talking about gay kids in America, about it stretching to kids in America, which is acceptable. If we've done this, how did we do it? How did we start forgetting about our children, and what did we turn our attention to? Do you have an opinion?
I think in the United States and in European countries, there was a time in which we did provide adolescents direction in how to manage their sexuality. There was a time in which parents provided this within the context of families, and communities provided this direction in the context of organizations and churches and community functions.
Do we go back to the 50s or before for that time that you're talking about?
Well, I don't think we have to turn back the clock. I think we can...
No, I don't mean do we turn back. I don't mean turning back the clock to get to it. I'm saying in your reference when you're saying, well, there was a time when we provided sexual guidance and other guidance for our kids. And I'm saying, well, when was that? How far do we go back to find that time?
Well, if you turn back to the 50s, there wasn't education provided to the same extent that perhaps we have today, but at least society provided rules that people understood and that teenagers understood in managing their relationships. Perhaps they did not enjoy their sexuality to the extent that they might have, and yet they knew what the rules were. And today's teenagers don't get that kind of guidance and support from the communities around them. They don't know the rules.
Well, I think we have to look at what's happening in society general. Generally, we're a very materialistic society. Our emphasis is not on support of families. There are a number of people who are concerned about family breakdowns. I think many of these would like to support families, and I'd be very much for that, but we have to remember that there are an awful lot of children who are in families that have already broken down, and they're in need of services. And we have been, particularly during the last 10 years, cutting funds for every sort of program that would provide services, and it is just getting worse. I think many people would not believe how difficult it is to find even basic services for kids. I see kids in my clinics who are 15 and 16 years old. They're sleeping on the streets. They're, as I mentioned, there's no home for unmarried mothers. There's almost no services for kids with mental health problems, unless, of course, you're fairly well off. If your family will pay for this privately, that's fine. You have these services available. But as we know, there are an awful lot of families, and particularly those with children, that are at the poverty level, and these are just not eligible for hardly any services at all. I think we've got to get our values straight in this country, because no nation can exist and really amount to very much where it totally disregards its children as much as we have in this country. It is really shameful. I am ashamed to talk about the services we have with some of the people in European countries, the Scandinavian countries, Holland, well, most of the European countries. It's really, I'm really ashamed.
When I was young, it seems to me that in my community, the home for unwed mothers, for example, was something that was a wealthy person had endowed it, and then it was supported by the various women's groups and church groups around the community. Many of the services that were common in my community came through the church or came through social groups, but they weren't necessarily the Department of Health and Social Services or the Resource Center for Parents and Children. It wasn't separate from the fabric of society. It was combined kind of in the neighborhood. I wonder how we get there from here, if that was adequate in the 1950s to the need. Is it something, is that a way, I guess I'm asking you, is that a way to provide services? If we're not doing so well through the state, through the city, through the municipality in providing services.
Well, I think the private sector certainly has been aware of this problem and is doing something. But you have to look at all the changes that have gone on with the doubling of our population in a relatively short time. People are just not as community-oriented. The communities have broken down as well as families. And the support that was there in terms of churches and other organizations is just not present anymore. I think that for a while, the federal and state governments stepped in and were providing some of this. But certainly during the last 10 years, there's been a complete reversal of this, and funding has been pulled out, the idea being often stated that the private sector would pick it up. Well, it hasn't. I don't know the reason for this. Certainly, there's been a great deal of attempts by various people to get more private sector involvement, but it hasn't happened. So what we're faced with is just a real serious lack of essential services for children and youth.
And where do you see they might come from when you stand and look at the lack? Where in our society do you think might provide it?
Well, I think that we need to have more governmental concern with this. For instance, in the countries that I mentioned in Europe, many of them are criticized as being socialistic societies, you know, and people will say, well, if you lived there, you would have to pay a lot of taxes. Yes, that's true. They pay more taxes than we do. Mm-hmm. But they have services, really good services, and they don't have the problems in delinquency, in teenage pregnancy, in mental health that we do in this country. Mm-hmm. But they pay for them, and I think we've got to be willing to say, as individuals, as taxpayers, as private organizations who can do it, that this is a responsibility we haven't taken, and we're going to have to if we have any interest in the welfare of the country.
Gary Romafetti, any thoughts on that?
I think first we have to reach some agreement on what we want teenagers to receive. What kind of services are we going to agree to provide in the arena of these sexual matters? You know, can we agree that they need sexual education? Can we agree that they need the availability of contraceptive services? Can we agree that they need to have positive adult role models? Can we agree that they need to be having freedom from sexual exploitation? Once we can agree on what teenagers deserve to receive from our society, then each and every community can decide in its own way who is best suited to provide that. Is it the local physician's responsibility, or the school's responsibility, or parents, or churches? Perhaps we all share that responsibility to provide for those things. And once we can reach some agreement on what to provide, then maybe we can start learning how to do it over again.
So I do wonder if we'll ever reach agreement, though. The subjects you mentioned are one, are some on which very few of us agree.
Well, I think some communities are further than others in reaching agreement on those matters.
We had a very disappointing thing happen in our state, the state of Washington, last week. There was an initiative on the ballot called the Children's Initiative, which would have provided for many of the services that have been cut and have disappeared. And there was a lot of effort made by leading citizens, including the governor, to get this passed. It would have meant a small tax increase, but all of this would be earmarked for children's services. And this was resoundingly defeated by about 5-1. I sometimes wonder if it's ignorance, it's just lack of caring, or what is going on with people today that they are so callous and totally lacking in concern for the youth. I mean, the future of this country is going to be based on its youth, and yet we're totally losing this group of young people. Sure, I know there are some who, you know, come from families that are still fairly strong and they have economic stability. But if you just look at the statistics about the number of families, particularly those with children that are slipping below the poverty level, all these children are needing services which are not available.
Gary, you indicated that in some places there was beginning to be consensus on the importance of caring for children who have not been cared for heretofore. We're an example. We have a poor example from the state of Washington, from Seattle. Is there an optimistic example from somewhere around Minnesota?
I think across the country we're reaching some national consensus on sexual education of children and adolescents, perhaps more of a consensus for adolescents than children. I think most people in the country would agree that teenagers have to learn about responsible sexual expression. Now, what the content of that education is a matter still of a lot of contentious debate. But at least we've gotten so far as to say that kids need to be educated.
And that's a
first step.
And this is arising because of the pandemic AIDS and the awareness that other STDs are very dangerous too.
Yes, and adolescent pregnancy.
I'm not sure that I quite see the optimistic side of it as you do, because it seems to me, particularly within the last year, there's been retrenchment of this on the part of many schools who have had or were planning on more sex education, AIDS education, have been retrenching on this. At least out in our area, there have been many very conservative people put on school boards who have halted sex education, saying that all this does is teach kids to be more sexual and to do things that they wouldn't do otherwise. And then often this goes back to, well, it's the family's responsibility. The thing I think people have to understand that there are so many kids who don't have families. I mean, there's one parent family, perhaps a mother with four or five children. She's not able to function in the way that the family is supposed to exist. It takes everything that this woman has to survive, and she can't meet the needs of these children. And we're not helping at all as a society. I get very upset, as you can see, when I get on this subject.
You've been working with street kids for how long?
Almost 20 years.
And how has it changed in the 20 years you've been working on it? It had to be bad, or you wouldn't have started 20 years ago, yes?
Well, there weren't nearly as many people, young adolescents on the street 20 years ago as there are now. But those that were there, I was concerned because they weren't getting any medical care, at least not that we could find out. And so we set up a clinic just to see if we set up one specifically for them in an area where they congregated, particularly in the evening, if they would come in for medical care. And we found they did. And so we have gradually increased until we now operate 3 clinics a week. And we see, I would say, the majority of kids who are on the street feel comfortable and come there. What's happened is there is a gradual increase in the number of kids. The street scene 10 years ago was nothing compared to what it is now. There were drugs at that time, but they weren't the same drugs that there are now. The violence, the prostitution, the number of girls that are being pimped, that are being seriously physically abused, and the number of girls who become pregnant, deliver babies that are, I'm sure, not going to be functional individuals when they reach adulthood because of the mother's drug use or drug addiction. It's gotten a great deal worse.
What's the range of their medical and psychiatric needs these days? I mean, how do you serve these kids when they come in, or what do they ask for?
Well, the ones we see really come in because they have medical problems, mm-hmm. and our clinics are not functioning as a social service agency. We do find that when we're taking care of their medical problems, that they have, incidentally, no place to live, and that they need a whole host of other services. We try as best we can to find some place. For instance, if you have a 15-year-old with a temperature of 105, and he tells you that he's been sleeping on the street in a sleeping bag between two buildings, and the temperature outside is below freezing, you're very concerned. And sometimes we spend hours just finding a place for this kid to go and get off the street.
Mm-hmm. Bob Nischer, I should say again, is a professor emeritus of pediatrics at the University of Washington. He is currently director of free teen clinics for street kids. Dr. Gary Remifedi is medical coordinator of the Adolescent Health Program in Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota Hospital and directs University of Minnesota's Youth and AIDS Project. Let's take an opportunity to listen to you about that project, as we've been talking about Bob Dasher's projects on the side as well.
Yes, the project is rooted in some of the facts about AIDS in teenagers. Right now, there are 1,200 cases in the United States of full-blown AIDS cases in teenagers between the ages of 13 all the way up to 21, so that includes the young adults. And when we look at the breakdown of who are those young people who are getting HIV, we find that about 70% of them have gotten that illness through homosexual behaviors, and about 17% through heterosexual activity and 13% through drug use. In our own state, we have 27 adolescents in Minnesota who have HIV infections that we know of, and almost all the kids who didn't get it through infected blood products got it through homosexual activity. As an outgrowth of the facts about who's getting AIDS in Minnesota and the country, we devised a special program for gay and bisexual kids of prevention and service for those young people who already are infected. As Bob's comments have indicated, if you really want to reach kids at risk, you can't expect them to come to the ivory towers of the university. So we have a very aggressive and eclectic outreach to them to try and bring our services to them. When we do reach these young men, we provide them with an assessment of what their risk for HIV is and what their drug use is and what their psychosocial needs are. And based on that, we recommend to them particular services and actually help them get there, provide a case manager for them, someone who is a positive role model also to them, who can help them access the services they need in order to do a better job of AIDS prevention or to get care for existing problems. And also we provide them with extensive education, including education by their peers, since so often it's difficult for them to hear a message from an adult. It's much more accessible to them if it comes from someone their own age.
Mm-hmm. 1,200 in the nation, 70-some in the state of Minnesota. These are small numbers. Are these numbers like the numbers 6-8 years ago for adult people who had AIDS? Are these numbers going to explode?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the largest increases in AIDS cases and asymptomatic HIV cases are in young people. When you stop to think about it, in the United States there are 100,000 AIDS cases, and 20% of those cases, 20,000, occurred in people who are 20 to 29 year olds. And we know that this illness takes about 7-8 years before it manifests itself. And so as many as 20,000 of those cases were probably first acquired during the teenage years. Mm-hmm. That gives you some sense of the scope of the problem. This year alone, AIDS became the 7th leading cause of adolescent deaths. It became the leading cause of death of young men in the military. These are really extraordinary phenomena. And in some parts of the country where seroprevalence tests are being done, the antibody test is being done, so detecting people before they're symptomatic, we find that in some groups, like boys who are involved in prostitution, already 15% of them in New York City are infected. In some parts of the Bronx and Brooklyn, 5% of young women who are mothers are infected at the hospitals that are testing. So the problem is truly extraordinary, and I think we've only just seen the tip of the iceberg.
Can we reach gay or straight teens the way the gay male community in this country reached itself? I mean, the behaviors have been turned around, whether permanently or not, we don't know. But they've certainly been turned around so that other groups are passing up gay men as the victims of HIV. Can teens be turned around in this way?
Absolutely. I have the utmost confidence in it. And based on the work that we're doing with teenagers who come to us in a situation of being at extremely high risk and very needy in so many areas, and we're actually able to help them remedy some of the problems in their lives, give them positive role models, give them friendship and peers, and improve their self-esteem and provide the services, and they're doing a much better job in the aftermath with preventing AIDS.
It sounds, except for the overt education, as if you're providing the services of a family.
In a sense, that's right.
Bob Dysher, your concern is teen pregnancies, teen suicides, teen illnesses for kids on the street. Can the kids on the street be turned around? Or are the drugs just too damaging?
Well, I think that the drug problem is certainly one of the most serious things that we face, and I don't have the answer to that, and it's pretty obvious that no one else does at any level. However, I think that there are a lot of things that could be helped a great deal. For instance, we find many of our girls becoming pregnant, and they say at that time that they want to they want the baby and they would like to get out of prostitution. They'd like to have a place to live, but what do we offer them? We offer them nothing, and they have to go back. They live in the crack house with the pimp where they were before they became pregnant. I would say that over 50% of girls, if given an option of getting off the street, out of prostitution, and having a place to live, they would do it. The same way with street kids. Many of them would like to go home. Many of them who have run away from home are sometimes doing this because it's really the safest thing. You couldn't believe the stories I've heard about kids being abused. I was talking to a couple not long ago, and I asked a 14-year-old boy why he'd ran away from home, and he said, well, his stepfather used to beat him, and he said, one night he got drunk and he got after me with a 2x4, and he said, I thought, if I don't get out of here, I'm really going to get killed. And I turned to a girl who was 15, and I said, what did you run away from? And she said, well, my mother's boyfriend was always trying to have sex with me. And I said, well, your mother was there. Couldn't you talk to her? And she said, oh, she was drunk all the time and thought it was funny. Mm-hmm. Now, these are typical stories. There's nothing unusual about them. And sometimes I think the kids who run away from these destructive and abusive situations are healthier. But we offer them nothing. Once they run away, they're really on their own. If you're a kid on the street, you're 15 or 16, you're not going to starve to death. You're going to turn to delinquency, picking parking meters, stealing, or what's probably most popular of all, prostitution, because you make more money and there's less risk to it.
What a note on which to end our program. Dr. Robert Teicher, Dr. Gary Remifetti, I want to thank you both for spending time with us. We've spent an hour talking about gay kids and straight kids, both in great difficulty. Thank you for joining us, and thanks for your work. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Sunday at Noon.